Please call the case.
Calling case number SCWC 13137, Nishimura v. Gentry Homes Limited. Arguing for the petitioner, Melvin Y. Agena. Also appearing for the petitioner, Graham B. Lipsmith. Arguing for the respondent, Ryan H. Engel. Also appearing for the respondent, Sarah M. Love. Arguing on the merits.
Good morning, counselor. Are you all ready to proceed today? All right, and Mr. Agena, you have reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll give you a warning with 10 minutes to go. Mr. Engel will give you a five-minute warning as you near the end of your argument. Please proceed.
The issue here before this court is what standard is applied when there is a challenge to the arbitration selectivity clause in an arbitration agreement. As far as I understand it, this is a case of issue of first impression here in the state courts. Gentry argued below and at the ICA level that the proof is actual bias or partiality. That's the standard that Gentry had argued. The ICA agreed with Gentry and relied upon 9 U.S.C. 10 and ruled that the circuit court should have confined judicial review to the fairness of the completed arbitration award. The court further ruled that the procedure is a motion to vacate after the award, and that the standard. The standard is the arbitrator bias or partiality. The plaintiffs naturally disagree. We believe that the correct standard to be applied when you're looking at the selectivity clause is fundamental fairness in it. That is the standard. And this issue must be decided before you begin the process. In the Sixth Circuit Court cases, McMullen especially, it addresses really the ICA opinion on the motion to vacate after the arbitration is done. What the Sixth Circuit Court said is that this procedure is true for allegations of potential or hypothetical bias among the arbitrators. It does not apply where the allegation is the arbitrator selection process is fundamentally unfair. I submit to you that the reason that they have the rule this way is because when you agree or when you are forced into an arbitration situation, a binding arbitration situation, what you're doing is you're giving up your constitutional rights to a jury trial. That's really the effect of all of this. And according to the case law, the federal case law, it talks about the difference between arbitration and the judiciary. And basically, as I understand the federal cases, what they're saying basically is that when you go into arbitration, the forum must take the place of the judiciary. And the language that the cases use is that it is simply a different forum to vindicate one's rights. If there's no fairness, there is no vindication of that right. In McMullen, what it says is when the process to select an arbitrator is fundamentally unfair, the arbitration forum is not an effective substitute for a judicial forum, and there is no need to present separate evidence of bias or corruption of the arbitrator selected. Now, I submit to you that the reason that you have to take a look at the process when you go into arbitration, is there is no right to appeal a mistake of law or a mistake of fact. You just don't have that right in a binding arbitration situation. Unlike the court when we enter the judiciary, there is no automatic right to appeal. There is no protection of an appellate court. There is no protection of the Supreme Court. This case is a classic example of the protection that we have and the safeguards when we file a claim in court.
Mr. Agena, could I just ask you, the agreement here, as I understand it, is that the arbitration shall be conducted by Construction Arbitration Services, and they're not in the picture anymore, or such other reputable arbitration service that PWC shall select at its sole discretion. If the agreement had simply said, rather than such other reputable arbitration service, if it had said the American Arbitration Association or Dispute Resolution Hawaii as PWC shall select, would that be okay?
Are you saying that if the agreement required either AAA or DPR?
Yes.
And the reason for it is that going into the arbitration, you know which service is going to govern. And also, as far as the reputation is concerned, for AAA as well as DPR, there is no question that they're fair and impartial.
Okay, so if that's what the agreement provided for, you wouldn't have a problem, even if the company had the ability to pick one of those two services?
That is correct. I would not have a problem with that at all.
Isn't the concern that it's more on the process, really, rather than the arbitrator?
That is correct. That's my understanding of
and,
the case law.
And that's what your argument is you're looking at the way this arbitrator was going to be chosen, the selection process versus who ultimately it would be.
That is absolutely correct, sir.
I guess why I'm asking the question is it the fact that there's a choice, or is it the fact that the choice is open-ended? And I guess what you're saying is it's the fact that the choice is open-ended other than there's a requirement that it be a reputable arbitration service.
That's partially correct, and I agree with you. The choice is open-ended. In addition to that, you have somebody designated, i.e. PWC, as the one to select the service. In addition to that, if you look at the briefs, PWC is closely aligned with the insurance industry, the builders, and Gentry.
Are they the warranty administrator?
Yes. And as part of that administration, or as part of that administration, by contract, they select the service. And keep in mind, PWC is being paid by Gentry pursuant to the contract, or somebody on Gentry's behalf is paying PWC. So if you cut to the chase of this, PWC is being paid by Gentry to randomly select some arbitration service. That's what it comes down to. And if you look at the warranty provision, what it says clearly is that PWC is acting on our behalf.
Can you expand a little bit on terms of what they're being paid for?
The way I understand the way I understand it anyways, they're being paid to administer the warranty. When you go into a situation like this, naturally, there's a lot of, for lack of a better description, paperwork that goes along to this. You have to file this and you have to file that. And PWC administers all of that and then selects the arbitration service.
Because part of the administration includes selecting the arbitrator.
That is correct, yes. And that's right in the warranty agreement.
Mr. Genn, if we accept your proposition that the standard of fundamental fairness should be applied, the remedy that you're looking for is to follow through with the remedy that was developed by the circuit court judge?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. And, you know, I know there's some reference by Gentry that the judge relied on the wrong rule. I believe it's Circuit Court Rule 12.2, which speaks to the issue of non-binding arbitration. And I have to agree with Gentry on that one. I don't believe that Rule 12.2 applies in this particular case, except keep in mind it's harmless error. And the reason for it is under 9 U.S.C. 5, it allows the court to select an arbitrator or an arbitration service. That's called for under the FAA. And in this particular case, Judge Nishimura went one step further. What she started with is a proposition, hey, you guys, select somebody, an arbitration service. And I'm sure if we selected an arbitrator by agreement, she'd be fine with that. She's giving us a chance to have input in who the arbitrator or the service is going to be. That's why binding arbitrations work. People have a feeling that I had input in this, it's going to be fair. That's what she was looking at. And what she said, ultimately, if you cannot agree, I'll pick somebody.
What's the second half of 12.2A, which says the court may order such process that the court determines may be helpful in encouraging an economic and fair resolution of all or any part of the disputes presented in this matter? Why couldn't the court order two parties to try to reach an agreement if they don't reach agreement on the arbitrator and the court appoints?
I agree. Well, in terms of trying to get the process going by the mutual agreement, I agree.
That's part of 12.2.
Yes, I agree with that. What I'm not clear on with 12.2 is her selecting the arbitrator. And I think that under 12.2, you can do it for non-binding arbitrations or mediation or some other ADR process or alternative dispute process. I don't know that you can do it under 12.2 and select an arbitrator for purposes of binding arbitration. But as far as her suggestion or instruction that go try and pick an arbitrator, I believe that's allowed under 12.2, so I agree with you on that. Going back to be the PWC, you know, in terms of, you know, their relationship with the insurance industry, gentry, and basically builders is what it is. I know if you look at the arbitration agreement, it clearly says PwC is acting on Gentry's behalf. And in the warranty, it says we have contracted with PwC. So there's clearly a contract, although I admit I do not have a contract, but right under the warranty itself, it says here that there is a contract between PwC and Gentry. Now, again, as you know, we put in all of our moving papers, the evidence before Judge Nishimura was the PwC website in addition to the warranty. And the website, the PwC website, advertises its strong relationships with builders. And what it says is it's worked with America's top builders to provide a warranty program. Its philosophy, strongest insurance program with a conservative business model. Then the PwC website advertises a strong relationship with one of the largest insurance companies in the United States and possibly in Europe, Zurich. Zurich, through one of its companies, Steadfast, is heavily involved in these cases at the circuit court level. These are construction defect cases that are ongoing in circuit court. This was the evidence before Judge Nishimura. This is what she made her decision upon. And I submit to you that based upon what she read and reviewed, she came to the conclusion that there is a potential conflict. And as a result of that, she felt that the arbitration selectivity clause was unfair. Now, I agree that she may not have used those exact words, but again, her overall looking at the evidence convinced her that there was something wrong with the selectivity clause, and she fashioned an appropriate remedy.
And so I want to make sure I understand. Below, you argued, I believe, you opposed arbitration in its entirety. But at this point, you are asking that this court rule on the issue of what the standard would be, fundamental, whether it's the fundamental fairness standard should be adopted.
In terms of the selectivity clause, that is correct. As far as going into binding arbitration, I agree with that. I think we should follow the contract, go into binding arbitration.
Okay.
I don't have any problems.
So that's no longer an issue?
It's not for me.
Okay.
And again, you know, just to put this in the proper perspective, you know, we're tossing a lot around PwC's bias, their relationship with the carriers, and everything else. The issue is not whether or not PwC will pick somebody who's fair and impartial. That's not the issue. The issue is whether or not the selectivity process is fair, i.e. having PwC pick an arbitration service when it's dependent upon Gentry, the insurance industry, who insures this claim, and basically builders. That's what the issue is. It's not a question of they will pick somebody who's biased. I don't know that. I just be guessing at that naturally. But again, that's not the issue. It's a question of the process itself, whether it's fair or not.
And I just want to come back again. This first question I asked, and now maybe it's appropriate to ask again at this point. Is it the, in your view, if this clause had given PwC the ability to choose but identified arbitration services like AAA or DPR, let's just stick with those two, and gave it the ability to choose between them, would that be okay, or would that even that level of discretion be inappropriate and unfair?
At that point, I believe it would be fair. And it would be fair to the consumers, again, because of the reputation of both AAA as well as
DPR.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So in that sense, I don't know how we can argue that the process isn't fair. Because you have impartial arbitration services deciding the issue just like a courtroom. So again, in response to your question, the answer is yes, I believe that would be fair. And I think that would be correct. You know, just to make sure about this in response to Justice McKenna's question in terms of severing out a portion of the arbitration agreement, that's what really the McMillan District Court did. In the second appeal, the 2006 appeal, that's exactly what the court did, the District Court. They severed a portion of it, the selectivity clause, went back up, it was affirmed by the Circuit Court.
In a sense, and maybe I got this, and the other side probably will, I'm sure, want to respond to this. If the argument is that the court has no authority to appoint an arbitrator, assume we accept that. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Let me
speak into the
microphone.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. You can step back and
yeah.
I apologize. If the argument is that the court has no authority to appoint an arbitrator in this situation. Wouldn't that be, the other half of that argument be, then the whole arbitration clause would have to be stricken?
Yes, but I don't agree with that argument.
I understand, but that would be the upshot, I guess, if you said that the court suddenly had no authority under law when you have this, assuming that if your argument was accepted, that the process was faulty, if you don't, can't go to the next step and have the court appoint the person, then you're going to have to strike the clause.
That part is correct. If there's no remedy, then yes, you'd have to strike the call, the clause itself. But again, that's where 9 U.S.C. 5 comes in, which allows a court to select an arbitrator, you know, when the regular process falls apart. Again, you know, in terms of, you know, what this case is about, I just want to again repeat myself that it's not about whether or not PwC will be fair or they're going to be biased. That's unnecessary to get that far. The issue is the process itself. Is it fair, you know, to the consumers as well as in this case Gentry? And I submit to you that it was not. I also submit to you that in terms of Judge Nishimura, she did the correct thing. And again, there's no magic words maybe in her order. Maybe she didn't use the word fundamentally unfair, but she got to the right result. Okay, so she may have relied in part upon 12.2 in selecting the arbitrator. Maybe that was error, but again, I submit to you it's harmless error. And the reason for it is what governs this and what drives this is really the FAA, which is 9 U.S.C. I do want to save some time for rebuttal if you have more questions.
Very well. Thank you. We'll hear from Mr. Engel at this point.
Good morning, Justices, and may it please the Court. I would respectfully submit that this is an area where the law and common sense are in complete accord. The ICA made the correct decision in vacating the trial court's order and asking that the parties be directed to proceed with the selection process set forth in the arbitration agreement. First, we need to take a step back from the wealth of case law and innuendo and accusations that are unfounded and not in the record with respect to PwC's role with regards to Gentry, how PwC is compensated, or any other unfounded allegations of bias. What we have to look at is the fact that the trial court was presented with a motion to compel arbitration. And under the FAA, the trial court was required to ask two questions. Does a valid arbitration agreement exist? And does this dispute fall within the scope of the arbitration agreement? I don't think anybody, including Mr. Argenta today, disputes that fact. What the trial court did expressly during the argument was attempt to forge a compromise between the parties and say that in order to avoid raising appealable issues, she was going to order the parties to agree on a local arbitration service. There was no authority under the FAA, there was no authority under the agreement, and I respectfully submit that Rule 12.2A, which applies to non-binding arbitration, did not provide her with authority either. There's no case statute or case law that would allow the court to effectively order a compromise upon the parties when there's a valid arbitration selection provision.
But if the provision is fundamentally unfair, the court can't fashion a remedy at that point? Under the Arbitration Act, the court has the ability to make the – or is it required to make the selection itself?
Correct, Your Honor. And I think, first of all, there are two issues on that. First of all, there would have to be evidence before the court that would raise the specter of applying a standard. Now, whether that standard is fundamentally unfair, as the Sixth Circuit has applied in certain instances, whether the standard is in unconscionability, which many other courts have applied, the question is which standard are they going to apply to those facts. First and foremost, there is no credible evidence in the record of any partiality, bias, or fundamental unfairness in PwC.
Let me ask you something, because you seem to be arguing that there has to be separate evidence of partiality, but that the terms on itself, on their face, could never be adequate to look at the process. Suppose the arbitration agreement had said something like PwC has to choose someone who finds for the builder 90% of the time. Suppose that had been right in the Would that be sufficient for you?
I would absolutely agree, Your Honor. That would be sufficient under an unconscionability standard or a fundamental fairness standard.
So then you do acknowledge that those two requirements that you just set forward, there is some ability of the court to look at the process that's involved and decide whether or not on its face that process raises question of fundamental fairness.
Correct, Your Honor. And under the Federal Arbitration Act, the arbitration provision can be set aside, and the enumerated instances are fraud, unconscionability, or some other basis is set aside the agreement of the party.
So the quibble here, or the dispute, is whether or not on its face there were questions of fundamental fairness.
Right? Well, I don't think, first of all, I would disagree that fundamental fairness is the applicable standard.
What would you argue?
I would say the issue is unconscionability. I would say that the correct standard to apply is unconscionability. That is a specifically enumerated basis under the FAA, and that is a standard that both the ICA and other courts have applied.
Is that what the Sixth Circuit applied?
The Sixth Circuit not apply unconscionability. It applied fundamental fairness. What I would submit with respect to the Sixth Circuit is a couple of issues. First of all, where there are no other cases that raise that the standard of fundamental fairness, it is neither mentioned in the FAA as a front end basis for setting aside the party's agreement to arbitrate, or a back end basis for setting aside an award. Second of all, with respect to the Sixth Circuit cases, particularly the Ryan's line of cases, what we're dealing with is, first of all, evidence of that was put forth, not that on the basis itself per se that the arbitration selection provision was improper, but the substantive evidence of the fact that there was virtually a symbiotic relationship between the employer and the arbitration service itself, where the arbitration service itself received 42% of its revenue from Ryan's, and where the pool of selected arbitrators involved both representative of other subscribing employees and employers and employees. Secondarily, I would say that the Ryan's cases also involve a separate issue, which involved federal statutory claims, particularly claims under Title VII, and they had to apply a separate analysis, which had to go to the effective vindication argument that was raised in the Gilmer case, where it applied to the discrimination of Age Discrimination Act.
So you think that a process in which a party's agent gets to unilaterally choose the arbitration service is fair?
I think under these facts it is fair, Your Honor. First of all, there are a couple of things. The warranty spells out many aspects of the arbitration. The warranty spells out where the arbitration is going to take place, that the parties to the arbitration agreement will bear their fees and costs equally, and provides enumerated basis, and it provides some of the remedies that the arbitrator can provide. It also says that in the event, obviously, CAS is not available, that it will select a separate, reputable arbitration company.
How does that impact what the fundamental fairness, as Mr. Again argues, or the selection of the arbitrator?
It doesn't impact the selection of the arbitrator, because all the PwC warranty is providing is that it will select an arbitration service. That arbitration will have rules and regulations for how arbitrators will be selected, and if those rules and regulations with respect to how an arbitrator would be selected are somehow unfair or provide for bias, that would provide a basis for vacating the award.
But nothing prevents them, as I, in my hypothetical, to look at those particular arbitration services that statistically rule strongly in favor of one side other than the other. But I'll give you the second question I want to ask too. If I understood you correct, even if we were to accept your distinction between unconscionability, even if we found that it was fundamentally unfair under your argument, even if it was fundamentally unfair, if it didn't rise to some higher level, which you consider unconscionability, right, the court has to back off.
Well, first of all, I don't think, I don't think the facts here either rise to the level of fundamentally unfair. The court, I don't believe fundamentally unfair would be the appropriate standard. The court could choose to apply that standard, but I don't think the facts under these circumstances rise to that.
If the unconscionability standard were applied by the trial court, that there would have been a different result?
I think if the unconscionability standard had been applied by the trial court would have simply ordered full compliance with the terms of the arbitration agreement and would have had the parties submit this to PwC, and PwC would have selected a third-party arbitration service.
You don't see any procedural unconscionability in an arbitration clause that allows one party to select the arbitrator with no input from the other party?
To be fair, PwC is not one of the parties to either this dispute. And, in fact, PwC has set forth in his warranty.
Well, it's your client's agent.
Well, It administers the warranty. It's set forth in the warranty. PwC has no obligation of fulfilling any of the.
Well, but it says any disputes between you and us or parties acting on our behalf, including PwC. So clearly, PwC is acting on your client's behalf.
I'm not certain, for Your Honor, that Justice McKenna, that if one of the interested parties selects the arbitration service, that would be unconscionable on its face, as long as the arbitration service is fair and provides a basis for the parties evaluating the arbitrators and setting aside biased arbitrators. I think it would be fair. Again, all we're talking about is a service. We're not talking about the arbitrators themselves, and we're not even in this instance, obviously, talking about Gentry. We're talking about a third-party warranty administrator that, you know, appellants cite the website, also state on the website that they are fair to both builders and homeowners alike.
And you don't think that the fact that you're fighting so hard to preserve the right to select that arbitration service, that doesn't reflect that not all things are equal?
I don't, Your Honor. I would like the parties to comply with the terms of their agreement, and I'm concerned about the implications of the court intervening and inserting new terms into the agreement, ordering the parties not to comply with it. I have grave concerns about whether the arbitration agreement itself and terms and conditions set forth in there still hold true if the court intervenes in order for the party to select a separate arbitration service.
I'm sorry, and what would the implication of those concerns be?
I'm concerned that they would select that because it would not fall within the gambit of the warranty, that an arbitrator would not follow the protocol set forth in the warranty agreement for purposes in order to how to evaluate its claims, whether the party would be responsible for their fees and costs, and the other procedures and protocols set forth there.
Can you speak up? I'm sorry.
Yeah,
please speak up.
Okay.
Sorry, yeah, just raise your voice. Sorry, we're having a hard time. And we'll try to raise can we raise the volume a bit on the mic, too? Please, thank you.
You're saying that you have a real fear that if both parties are allowed to have a say in what the arbitrator, who the arbitration service is, then you have a fear that an arbitration service would be selected that wouldn't comply with the terms of the arbitration?
Well, I don't think that the warranty ever contemplates, Your Honor, that a court would interfere and order us, for example, to agree to DPR. This is a company that administers a national warranty program, and my presumption would be that it would select arbitration services that are familiar with administering these kinds of warranties. Now, my concern is that when you have a national warranty program and a national party, and the court intervenes and appoints a local arbitration service that could result in a local arbitrator who doesn't have any experience with these things, but perhaps you could have somebody act outside the scope of the warranty.
But there would have been one way to cure that, and perhaps selected AAA or some other arbitration service that is well-respected and is known and is experienced in that type of business.
That's correct, yeah, but I also submit that I believe that was what PwC is required to do under its agreement now that CS is no longer in service.
I'm so sorry. Yeah. Could you repeat all of that? Yeah. I didn't catch it.
I would also submit, however, that I believe that PwC is required to select an arbitration service similar to that based on the fact that it is required to select a reputable arbitration service.
But that's within its sole discretion. So again, what it defines as reputable might not be one that might be one that viewed from an outside perspective or from the perspective of the homeowners isn't one that would be fair. Again, you know, what you've talked about are services that sort of do this for a living, and so the apparent intent would be to appoint a service that sort of does these kinds of cases. And I guess the argument might be inevitably has a tilt towards the industry.
And I think the problem with this line of argument, Your Honor, is we are simply engaging in speculation. We have not been given the opportunity to allow PwC to go forward and select an arbitration service in accordance with the party's agreement. If it were to do so and these facts were to become part of a record, then perhaps certainly the argument would be more compelling. But part of the problem here is I feel we are engaging in exactly what the Supreme Court has asked us not to do, which is to speculate and to presume that the parties and the arbitration service will act in a biased manner, in a non-neutral manner.
But that's true in the cases, all the Sixth Circuit cases, too. You know, again, it's the process that's suspect and not necessarily the particular arbitrator. In other words, you do look at the process. That is an appropriate inquiry, at least in the Sixth Circuit.
Correct, Your Honor, but I will also say that the Supreme Court and Gilmer, AT&T, and American Express all dealt with the same sorts of contentions and all found that the court should have very limited involvement in the process, that it had a very, that its obligation was to rigorously enforce the terms of the arbitration agreement, and absent
those, American Express dealt with arbitrations, arbitrator selection?
American Express dealt with other, what we would call fundamental fairness issues to some extent, Your Honor. For example, dealt with, there could certainly be the contention that being required to waive a class action arbitration right would be fundamentally unfair. But the Supreme Court held that it's not fundamentally unfair, that the obligation.
Did they use that language, fundamentally unfair?
No, it did not use that. But I'm saying you could apply this fundamental fairness standard to a variety of arguments.
The Supreme Court is basically ruling that arbitrations are not subject, class actions should not be arbitrated.
Right, and the petitioners in that case argued that that was a right that they should have, and the Supreme Court said, hey, the Federal Arbitration Act requires us to enforce the terms of these agreements, and absent some level of fraud and unconscionability, we're not going to interfere with that. So I would say that part of my problem with the fundamental fairness standard is you can make a fundamental fairness argument about a lot of things, but I'm not sure that really rises to the level of what courts are required to look at under the FAA.
What about the obligation of good faith in every contract? Should we call it a good faith requirement then? Section 2 of the FAA does allow a court to review contract arbitration clauses for any grounds that exist at law or equity for the revocation of any contract.
Correct, Your Honor. And I believe that if a court felt that fundamentally that the good faith of the agreement was issued, then it potentially could consider that. I'd be a little concerned when you look at the other side of the equation, when you have much higher standards for setting aside the arbitration award.
Oh, actually, it's actually good faith and fair dealing. Maybe that's where the Sixth Circuit gets fundamental fairness.
Yeah. And to be fair, it's not really clear where the Sixth Circuit gets that language, and it doesn't sort of carry over into any other cases. I mean, it appears to me that the Sixth Circuit looked at the facts of the case and felt there was something unfair or unconscionable about it. And
when arbitration clauses first started, we didn't have these types of clauses where, you know, usually the parties would select the arbitrator because you are giving up your right to a jury trial or your right to have the court look at your case. And so isn't it important that the parties can agree that this arbitrator to whom they're submitting their dispute is going to be fair? Fundamental to an arbitration clause?
Well, I think it's fundamental to an arbitration clause that the process is ultimately fair, Your Honor. But I would respectfully say that most contracts at this point.
And how can parties feel comfortable that the process is fair if they're not comfortable with the arbitrator, the arbitration selection process?
Well, again, Your Honor, we don't have either of those facts.
Well, I think the parties, the plaintiffs here, are not happy with the selection process.
With the arbitration selection process. But right. I would say in most contracts you enter into, Your Honor, the arbitration selection service has already been decided upon. And to the extent that applies equally to both parties, the court in Kay, for example, found that that was not in any way adhesionary or unconscionable or unacceptable. And that is functionally a fact of business today, that parties – often the party itself, as opposed to a third party like we have here, is designating the arbitration service.
And that seems like a much fairer process, that the designation is made at the time of the agreement. Both parties know, and if there's a problem, they can do something. Here, it's up to your agent.
I believe, Your Honor, that you know if you could contemplate every exception to an arbitration provision, we could. But they designated an entity that would serve as the arbitrator, under which no one would have a problem. And then they thought, effectively, what if this company was no longer in business? Most contracts don't provide for that caveat. Most contracts say it's going to be AAA. And if AAA is no longer in business, then you're going to have to go to a court. This third-party entity tried to accommodate it one step further and said, rather than face this problem, we're going to select another reputable arbitration service.
Did it say reputable?
It does, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I would say reputable is defined by Black's Law Dictionary. I mean, there is some standard for which a court, certainly when you look at these cases, could determine that an arbitration service was not reputable.
So does the court have the authority? Are you arguing that the court would then have the authority if the other side didn't believe it was reputable to challenge it?
I believe that's possible, Your Honor. I believe that under the FAA, it appears that you basically have two bites at the apple, the front end or at the back end.
Well, you're arguing at the back end, not the front.
I think at the back end, yes. If
what about the front end?
At the front end, if the evidence was not before the court at the time and the agreement on its face did not violate any standard that the court would apply, then I think the party's recourse would be to allow the process to go forward, and then if they have evidence, and the evidence would include clearly a war that they were not happy with.
I'm just really curious, below, which reputable services were suggested?
We never got to that point, Your Honor.
Never got to that point?
We never got to that point because
Judge Nishimura said you guys try to agree. Correct. And you're saying that PwC never even suggested another
PwC
reputable?
PwC did not select an arbitration form at that point. Under the warranty, the petitioners were required to submit a warranty claim to PwC to allow the process to play forward. They did not do that. They filed a lawsuit in circuit court, and we moved to compel arbitration. Had Judge Nishimura simply ordered the parties to comply with the arbitration agreement, then the dispute would have been submitted to PwC, and PwC would have proceeded to select an arbitration service.
And based on your answer, there would have been no basis to challenge that until the very end.
I think that's possible. Certainly the case, probably under the FAA, the court's going.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Mr. Engel, but then, as I guess Justice Pollack is pointing out, your position is, if the unconscionability standard is accepted by the court, it wouldn't apply in this case. You wouldn't feel that it was appropriate for the court to inquire at this time as to whether or not the process was unconscionable.
No, what I'm saying, Justice Wilson, is that I do not believe the facts before the court in the record rise to the level of finding that the process is unconscionable.
And the reason that you want the scrutiny to fall at the back end of the process is the standard is different at the back end, right?
The standard is different at the back end.
It's really difficult to overturn a...
I wouldn't say that's the reason I want it to be moved to the back end. I'm saying that I don't want, frankly, court interference with the terms of the arbitration agreement.
What's the standard on the back end?
Evident partiality or bias.
Fraud,
which is what the IC... No, fraud is different, Your Honor. That is a different basis, and that is effectively what the ICA did adopt. They basically viewed unconscionability as being defined as evident partiality or bias.
But just to clarify your answer to Justice Pollack, if the process had proceeded to the step of a reputable arbitration service being selected, and in the plaintiff's view, that arbitration service was one that was unfairly tilted in favor of the company, they would not have any recourse at that point under the law as you understand it. They would have to go through with the arbitration.
Well, I think that there are basically two readings of this. I think if you look at the FAA in its most sort of quote-unquote severe form of saying you're going to go to arbitration and you're going to stay there, I think under the statute, the FAA would say that your next level of recourse is after the award. I believe that at least one of the cases that that the petitioner cited may have involved effectively a party moving for injunctive relief prior to the arbitration award. Sorry. One of the cases cited may have involved, for example, a party moving for injunctive relief, and I suppose that is a possibility that a party could move for injunctive relief to say, hey, we have gone through this process, and now we have evidence, compelling evidence of unconscionability that requires that we, set aside this process.
So you think there's some authority for there being a remedy before the arbitration goes forward?
I think that, frankly, Your Honor, I think that would be prudent. I mean, if that means that a court is not going to, based on speculation at the front end, insert itself into the terms of the party's agreement, and something then occurs prior to the arbitration that rises to that level of unconscionability or clear bias, then I think that it would be fair for a party to be able to present that evidence.
It seems a little different when you said that the court only had two considerations when a motion to compel come before it. Is this a third now?
Well, under the statute, that's what the FAA appears to contemplate, that there's going to be a motion to compel arbitration, and at the back end, there's going to be a motion to confirm the award. It's so silent as to what happens in between.
So your argument is you don't like it up front. You you think there's no authority under the statute to do it before, but you're authorizing authority afterwards.
I'm fine with a challenge up front, Justice Pollack, but I believe that if there's going to be a challenge up front, a party has to do more than speculate that that the arbitration service, which has not even been selected yet, is going to be biased. So I clearly have no objection to the fact that a party is entitled to challenge the enforceability of an arbitration agreement, but I think the fundamental disagreement comes to what is the standard and what is the court going to ask for in enforcing that agreement.
But you did agree on my hypothetical that if it had said something like, you're going to go to one side that you're going to choose someone who favors one side 90% of the time or something like that. So certain terms would even be cause you concern.
Absolutely.
So it's the question in this case is not even, since we're kind of agreeing on the law to a certain extent, we may not be agreeing on fundamental fairness or unconscionability. The question is whether on the face of it, it rose to that level.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I don't think there's any question under the FAA or relevant case law that an arbitrator selection provision or an arbitration service can be set aside by a court. I think the question is, what is required in order to do that? And courts, you know, under Gilmer, for example, the Supreme Court said that the presumption should be that the arbitrator is going to be fair.
But Gilmer was not dealing with arbitration selection. It was just whether or not ADA claims are ADA claims were
age discrimination claims.
Right. ADEA claims are subject to arbitration. That was the issue. You know, so whatever along those lines, it was just dicta.
Well, yes, Your Honor, I think that's true with respect to Gilmer.
And what would the standard be in the challenge before? So say they went through the process, the service was selected that in the plaintiff's view was not one or was one that was unfairly tilted in favor of the company, and the injunctive action was brought. What would the review be at that point? It would be for actual bias, or it would be?
I bet it would apply the standard applied by the ICA up front. If that's your question, Justice, that it would be that they perceived the plaintiff's argument to be effectively an unconscionability argument.
So there would be an unconscionability analysis of the procedure or the provision in the contract.
I believe so, Your Honor. Yes.
Okay. In other words, the fact of the particular party that was selected or service that was selected would be evidence, I guess, of the unconscionability of the provision. Is
correct.
That?
That's the second option under the FAA. I mean, there are obviously two times when you can challenge, you know, certainly under the FAA, you can challenge up front and certainly you can challenge at the back. The standard for setting aside the award at the back end is evident partiality or bias. What the ICA determined in its opinion below was that it applied an unconscionability standard that effectively incorporated a partiality or bias component.
Can I follow up with the Chief Justice asking? So that he asked you about the standard afterwards. Would the standard before be the same, or would it would be the unconscionability of the procedure on its face, and then the one afterwards would be unconscionability, how it played out?
The standard at the end is evident partiality or bias. The standard at the front end has been fraud, unconscionability, or some other basis for setting aside the contract. Unconscionability being one that is most frequently applied challenges to the arbitration service or the arbitrator process itself.
But just to be clear, my question to you is if the process played out to the point of a service being selected, at that point you've cited a case or the plaintiffs have cited a case, and do you have the name of that case, by the way? If you
believe it may have been
well, you know, if you don't have it handy.
Right. It may have been the Floss case, Your Honor.
But oh, Floss.
One of them came before, and I may be wrong on that, but
okay.
One of them, I believe, came before the court immediately prior to the arbitration proceeding commencing.
Seeking an injunction to stop the arbitration. All right. At that point, then, it would be open to the plaintiff, under that line of or that case, it would be open to the plaintiff prior to the arbitration to file an action alleging that the selection process was unconscionable, and evidence of that fact or support for that assertion could be found in the service that, in fact, was selected.
Correct. And presumably, in that case, evidence came out between the process, the case being submitted to arbitration, and the day before the arbitration hearing itself, that led the party to believe that it would be a, you know, in that instance, fundamentally unfair or unconscionable process.
Could I make that challenge after arbitration had started, just during the proceedings, and say, you know, I didn't realize it was partial, but after we're halfway through it, during the discovery, or I just found out the discovery rules don't allow?
I believe actually the end of the FAA, Your Honor, one of the cases we cited involves a challenge during the arbitration hearing, and the court said, you'll have to wait. Now, we're not going to interject ourselves into the arbitration hearing itself, and this is a challenge that should be heard after the arbitration and after an award is issued.
Mr. Engel, could you help me with this interpretation that has been focused on as perhaps one particular part of the arbitration clause that might support the notion of fundamentally being unfair or maybe unconscionability? But it says, any disputes between you and us or parties acting on our behalf, including PwC. Now, I guess the interpretation that caused the concern was that PwC is identified as a party acting on behalf of a Gentry, but that might be a misinterpretation. I just was interested in your view of that.
I believe that would apply, Your Honor, with respect to the fact that PwC is administering the warranty. So if there is a dispute with respect to PwC's administration of the warranty, then they would be subject to the arbitration provision as well. I think it's a global effort, an effort to globally include all of the parties under an arbitration umbrella.
Thank you.
One last question. If there was this challenge made under your analysis, and the way the wording of the provision is, if there's a dispute about reputable, if the court were to find that it wasn't reputable, under the terminology of the agreement, it doesn't matter because it says, or other reputable arbitration service that PwC shall select at its sole discretion.
But I think it's still tied to reputableness, Your Honor. I mean, there's many provisions in contracts that say it's in the sole discretion, but it still is modified by the fundamental obligation of good faith and fair dealing.
Very well. Thank you very much, Mr. Engel. We'll hear in rebuttal now from Mr. Genna.
I think there was a reference in the argument about the sufficiency or the credibility of the evidence down below. But again, that's a trial court decision. Judge Nishimura looked at the evidence, decided, and she decided. That's an evidentiary question. There's a lot of talk and a lot of discussion about unconscionability as a standard for setting aside the selectivity clause. That language comes from naturally 9 U.S.C. 2, which what's generally referred to by the cases as the savings clause. You enforce unless there's unconscionability in a contract or, and this is what's very important, or equity. That's what the statute says. So again, in the context of where did McMullen get this fundamental fairness, obviously must have had it from the statute somewhere. And they didn't use the unconscionability test. They went to fundamental fairness. And I submit to you that one of the authorities that anyone can rely on is 9 U.S.C. 2, because again, it speaks to unconscionability as well as equity.
Actually, the word unconscionability does not appear in 2. It just says, save upon such grounds as exist at law or in equity.
I'm sorry, right. you are.
And
correct.
Then a lot of times this is analyzed. Unconscionability is often used.
I agree.
As an equitable concept.
Yeah, I misstated that.
So what about the argument that fundamental fairness is a minority view among the federal courts and that most federal courts, if I understood the argument, were adopting a presumably higher standard of unconscionability? Do you agree with that characterization? And if so, why do you think fundamental fairness represents a better approach?
Because on the issue of unconscionability that Gentry is talking about, that's a backing standard. And that's after the arbitration is completed. And you use that standard to challenge the arbitration award. That's what that's for. And in the context of the statement made by Gentry, possibly, that the Sixth Circuit is a minority view, I don't know any other view. I don't know any other federal cases that said that the Sixth Circuit Court is wrong. We disagree with the Sixth Circuit Court. As of yesterday, anyway, you know, when we looked it up, I saw no other federal cases that set the Sixth Circuit Court decision aside. And, you know, in the context of the back end of this, you know, like Justice Nakayama said, it's almost impossible to set aside an arbitration award. And some of you were in private practice before you took the bench. I don't know if you've ever set aside an arbitration award. I have never done so. And if you did, God bless you. You must be some of the best attorneys in the state of Hawaii. It's just not done. And the reason for it is you must focus upon basically the conduct of the arbitrator. Now, there was a reference to AT&T. And I guess what they're talking about is the holding of AT&T, which basically says you enforce an arbitration agreement according to its terms and conditions. It's an accurate statement of the case. And I agree with that. What the case does not say is that you enforce the agreement, even if the selectivity process is fundamentally unfair. It doesn't say that. And I submit to you, in the AT&T case, what Justice Scalia talked about in the context of our discussion really is fairness. And the way he gets there is AT&T. And what he says is that, and he uses the words, to have a class action forced upon AT&T is too risky for AT&T. And I submit to you what he was talking about is that it was unfair. And as much as I disagree with Justice Scalia, he was correct about this. And what he did was he listed the reasons in the contract that was very, very consumer-oriented. And the things that he listed are AT&T must pay all costs for a non-frivolous claim. Arbitration must take place in the county where the customer is billed. The customer chooses to participate by person, telephone, or submission. Either party may bring a claim in small claims court in lieu of arbitration. The arbitrator may award any type of individual relief to the consumer, including punitive damages. AT&T could not seek reimbursement fees. And if the award is greater than AT&T's last written offer, AT&T must pay a minimum of $7,500 plus twice the amount of the claimant's attorney fees. According to Justice Scalia, if you aggregated all of these things in the contract by tens of thousands, such as a class action case, the risk to AT&T becomes unacceptable. And I submit to you what he was talking about is to ram down a class action on AT&T that wasn't in the contract was unfair. And just to drive my point home, Justice Scalia also discussed the consumer, and he did it through the Ninth Circuit Court opinion. The aggrieved customer who filed the claim would be essentially guaranteed to be made whole. In addition to that, he cites the district court opinion that says the Concepcions would be better off under their arbitration agreement with AT&T instead of a class action. So again, in the context of the Concepcion case, there is discussion about fairness, not just to the consumer, but to AT&T as well.
What about Mr. Engel's argument that the opportunity exists to, once the selection of the service is made, there at least is some authority for allowing a pre-arbitration challenge? And if that is indeed true, and I'd be interested in your thoughts about those cases, is whether that opportunity should be allowed. If that's true, why not allow the process to continue that one additional step? Because perhaps, you know, for one possible outcome is you may be satisfied with the service, and another is if you're not, then there'd be further evidence of the process being an unfair one. What was your reaction to that argument?
My own feeling about that, if you engage in something like that, you're defeating the purpose of having an arbitration clause. The whole idea with arbitration is efficiency and timing so that it goes fast. The intent is to stay away from the courtroom once the process gets started. And if I listen to Mr. Engel, my understanding is he's talking about some sort of injunctive relief, which means you file a separate lawsuit, You go through a hearing, you get a preliminary injunction, you have an evidentiary hearing, and then you have a permanent injunction. At that point, what about the appellate process? What if someone appeals the decision? The arbitration is stuck in the background someplace for the next 2 or 3 years for the time it takes to run its course through the appellate system. That's what's wrong with it. If you're going to do that, why have arbitration at all? Why not just come to court? That's the whole idea, and that's the fundamental basis of 9 U.S.C. The idea is for the arbitration to take the place of a judicial forum. In addition to that, just generally speaking, you know, once you file a lawsuit and a motion to compel arbitration, once it goes into arbitration, there's a jurisdictional issue as well. Does the circuit court still have jurisdiction over the case? And it kind of depends on what the issue is, naturally, in terms of the arbitrable claims, et cetera. But again, that's another problem. Even if you file the lawsuit at the front end, how do you get it back to the circuit court so the court can listen to the arguments?
But this would be before the arbitrator had even been selected.
Yes, I agree. But a lot of times what happens is that you file your lawsuit and then there's a motion to compel arbitration. I submit to you the reason that it's done that way is because you want the circuit court to have jurisdiction. So at the time of confirmation, you go back to circuit court and confirm the arbitration award. But again, in terms of what Gentry was arguing in that intermediate step that you just referred to, they're talking about injunctive relief. That's what I heard anyway. You file a lawsuit for injunctive relief. You're back in the court system all over again. It defeats the entire purpose of speedy resolution of an arbitrable claim. That's what it comes down to. And that's why I believe it doesn't work. I don't read these cases very well. I'll be totally honest with you. Whenever I read it, it just gives me a headache. I don't understand it, especially the U.S. Supreme Court case. I'm not an appellate attorney. One thing that comes out to me very clearly in the simple way I read cases, when you look at the Sixth Circuit Court case and even AT&T versus Conception, is this thread that comes through that the process itself must be fair. And the underlying reason for that principle is because arbitration takes the place of the judiciary. You know, I work down where the rubber meets the road. I deal with clients and consumers and everything else. The one thing that they all agree with is that judges, they absolutely believe that judges are fair. That's why settlement conferences are so successful. The client may not agree with the attorney, the client may not agree with me, I give them my analysis. When we go to court, they may not agree with the judge, but they believe, they honestly believe that the judge is fair. And I've heard clients tell me, you know, I don't agree, but if the judge said it, he's fair, so I believe him. To a certain extent, I've had settlements come out that way. In terms of the arbitration process, you know, keep in mind that this is styled as a class action. Granted, we haven't done class certification yet. We're dealing with 3,000 consumers, potentially. They need to have that same feeling when they go to arbitration, that it's going to be absolutely fair. And again, if you don't apply the fundamental fairness test, and if we don't follow Judge Nishimura's directive, you're not going to have that.
Again, however, you're not contesting arbitration at this point.
No, I am not, for sure. Just selectivity process. I'm for arbitration, and I was probably the last old guy to get on board with that, but I believe it works. But again, the issue is the process, and that's what the consumer has to feel, that when they go into arbitration, it's just like going into court.
We wouldn't be here, actually. You offered to have a jointly choose an arbitrator way back, didn't you?
Yes, and in response to, I believe, Justice McKenna, your question, did we get to the point between Mr. Engel and myself to choose or discuss an arbitrator? The answer is no, and the reason for it is that Gentry decided to file the appeal instead. It's not a criticism of Gentry. You know, they have a duty and a right to do whatever Mr. Engel feels is right for his client, but that's the answer to your question. So we never got that far. I think I did say, you want to talk about this, and I think he said he needs to clear it with the client, and then the appeal followed after that. If you don't have any more questions, I'll sit, and thank you so much for hearing this case.
Very well. Thank you to both of our attorneys here today for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement.